This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, who recently switched to the Republican Party, is asking President Trump for more help for the coal industry. Glynis Board reports that Justice wants payments from the federal government to offset the costs of Appalachian coal.
Come on up, Jim. Look at this guy.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice announced he'd revert back to the Republican Party during a recent Trump rally in West Virginia. During a press conference afterwards, he explained that he believes he can accomplish more as a Republican on state and national fronts. One of the big ideas he's pushing at the White House, a $4.5 billion subsidy for Appalachian coal. He says it's a matter of national security.
I want our president to move forward with the possibility of creating a homeland security incentive for all Central App or Northern App coal that is purchased by our eastern power plants.
Appalachian coal is the most expensive in the country at $45 to $55 per ton. Larger, easier mined coal seams in the West sell for $12 to $30 per ton. Justice wants a $15 per ton subsidy to help eastern coal compete. His pitch to Washington is that the subsidy will bring coal jobs and secure the nation's eastern electrical grid in case terrorists attack.
$4.5 billion a year is just an absolute fraction of the price to pay for security, for protection.
Still, many policy analysts say there's little economic justification for a coal subsidy. Western coal associations call Justice's subsidy idea misguided, big government market manipulation. Energy policy expert Jason Bordoff served during the Obama administration on the National Security Council, where he spent a lot of time considering threats to energy security.
This seems like a rather transparent effort to subsidize an industry that has been in structural decline for not only years, but decades.
Bordoff points out that government stockpiles of coal and oil already exist.
While concerns about fuel supply reliability are legitimate, picking winners by subsidizing the production in the name of national security of one fuel that is declining because of all these market forces is not a smart or cost-effective solution.
Bordoff says even with a subsidy, Appalachia's coal industry isn't likely to turn around. He says time and money would be better spent building up new economies to support communities throughout the region. But Justice says the White House is considering his idea, but no promises have been made. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling, West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:47. Areas of fog this morning becoming partly sunny. There's a chance of rain and thunderstorms today with highs in the 80s. Rain and thunderstorms tonight with heavy rain possible, lows in the 60s. Rain and thunderstorms early tomorrow, clearing in the afternoon with highs in the 80s. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by Shentel, providing internet as well as home phone and cable TV to West Virginia. For more information, visit Shentel.com. Shentel, always connected to you. The shocking events in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend are yet another reminder of deep division in America. More specifically, it seems like battles that ripped our nation apart 150 years ago continue to smolder. West Virginia Public Broadcasting produces a podcast called Us and Them, which tells the stories from America's culture divides. As we process the Charlottesville tragedy, we thought we'd check in with Us and Them host Trey Kay, who has reported extensively about the removal of Confederate monuments, symbols, and icons, and the tense emotions and antipathy that are stirred on both sides of the debate. Jesse Wright recently sat down with Trey to talk about recent events.
I don't really think much of a conversation is going on. Not a productive conversation, anyway. I mean, neither side is listening.
Hi, Trey.
Hey, Jesse.
I've listened to a number of episodes from Us and Them's back catalog and noticed that you've done a lot of reporting about the removal of Confederate monuments.
It does seem like these monuments are not going to go gentle into that good night. As we saw last weekend, a lot of people are passionate about retiring these symbols out of the public square and into museums. And there are others who have declared that these monuments will be taken down over their dead bodies.
Well, this weekend's events were certainly an eye-opener, especially in that regard, but the issue is far from a new one. When did you first start tracking the subject?
Back in 2011, I did a report about the history of the song Dixie, how it was written by a Northerner and it was beloved all over the country. After the war, during Reconstruction, Southerners adopted the song as an anthem to the lost cause of the Confederacy. The lost cause was, and is, a set of beliefs by whites in the Deep South that view the Confederate cause as gallant and a heroic fight against great odds despite its defeat. In my report about Dixie, I spoke with some Southerners who believe that removing Confederate icons is tantamount to cultural genocide.
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive. It's a form of cultural genocide in that it's stamping out a culture that really is not a threat to anyone.
That's Glenn McConnell, who was at the time the lieutenant governor of South Carolina. He was very upset that the Citadel, a famous military college in that state, had stopped playing Dixie at football games back in the 1990s.
If we become intolerant and we start excluding things, we're on a slippery slope. And it eventually erodes that part of history, that part of the culture. Racism has occurred north and south and everywhere. And you can't change what occurred. But you can grow from it. And I don't think growing from it is excluding it.
I understand the former lieutenant governor's argument about editing history and how that can be problematic, but his comment about racism having occurred in the North and the South really stood out. It seems like the heart of the matter of what happened in Charlottesville is really the tension about race.
In my experience in speaking with people who love the Confederacy, there's a struggle for how to reconcile the South's record on race. I find that many of the people fall somewhere between two poles in their thoughts about the Confederacy. One position sees a benign version of the Confederacy, and the other side sees a more malignant, poisonous understanding of history. As to the more poisonous version, I experienced that last winter when I was in Charleston, South Carolina, observing the penalty phase of the Dylann Roof murder trial.
So you're talking about the young white supremacist who shot and killed 9 worshippers at the Mother Emanuel AME Church back in June 2015?
That's right. I mean, Roof is clearly an example of this more malignant view of how race factored into the Civil War. I mean, he claims to have no confusion about the reasons for the war. And for him, it was about maintaining superiority of the white race. Now, that's one dark point of view. And I can't say how pervasive that view is in the South, but clearly many people share that worldview, and they showed up in Charlottesville this past weekend. Then there's another less dark perspective that I hear often from Confederate defenders. They tell me that I've been taught a bunch of myths about race relations in the South. In one of our podcasts, I speak with Alice Moore, whom listeners in West Virginia might remember from her time as a member of the Kanawha County Board of Education during the 1974 textbook controversy. She's a proud daughter of the South, and she says that black people and white people got along before Reconstruction. And she says that slavery really wasn't that bad.
Those people lived in communities where the children played together, and they lived basically peaceful lives. People in the South didn't hate each other. Black people and white people didn't hate each other. We had a separated society to a great extent, but you didn't have hatred down here. This is the heart of a country where people believe the Bible is the Word of God, and they don't believe in treating other people in evil and cruel ways.
I know several people who might dispute her account. It seems to be part of the problem, maybe Americans' inability to agree on a basic understanding of history.
I think that's right.
I heard sentiments similar to Alice's in another episode of Us and Them, which features two American reporters who live in East Africa. They report on the civil wars that are taking place in that part of the world. They travel back home to report on what seems to be America's unfinished civil war.
Yeah, you're talking about Charleston native Rupa Goganeni and her colleague Mike Onyego. So after New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu proposed taking down four of the city's Confederate monuments, Mike and Rupa spoke with many residents who were angry about that decision.
Have you read the slave narratives?
Some of them, yeah.
One of the opposition used those today because a whole lot of them, not all of them, because nothing's 100%, a whole lot of them said it wasn't so bad and they don't want that getting out there. You know, any institution can be abused and will be abused, mm-hmm. any of them. And the institution of slavery, the people were abused, not all of them. Right. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's right or moral or anything. I'm telling you the way they thought.
Why are we, you know, because some people have made this argument as well, and I just wonder why people even engage in this specific part of it, because, like, this is America, freedom is all. And whether or not they're well treated, they didn't have their freedom, so, like, why would we even engage in this line of, you know?
That was the thinking of the day, mm-hmm. you know?
But Mike and Rupa also speak with New Orleanians who have a very different understanding of the history of slavery and black people in the New Orleans area.
Yeah, they spoke with Malcolm Suber, a longtime activist and union organizer. And for years, Malcolm has offered what he calls hidden history tours in New Orleans, which he hopes might change what he sees as the Disneyfication of the Old South.
According to the official tours in the city, New Orleans was a great place in the 1840s, antebellum period. And that was the pinnacle of their civilization, and that was destroyed by the Civil War. That's their narrative.
Whose narrative?
The official tour guides in the city, that's their narrative. It's a Confederate story. It's a love affair of the Confederacy. And that's the thing that they want to glorify. They tell you about these houses were built by this architect, that architect, blah, blah, blah. But what they don't tell you is, how is it that this family had money to do that?
So your stated mission in producing Us and Them podcast is really to try to foster an understanding between people with very different worldviews. After doing your own reporting and then listening to Rupa and Mike's experience in New Orleans, what do you think is the state of the conversation about removing Confederate monuments and icons?
I don't really think much of a conversation is going on. Not a productive conversation, anyway. I mean, neither side is listening. Both sides are talking loud, but no one is persuading each other. I think it's a stalemate.
Well, and this tension has been going on for 150 years. I mean, what do you think it would take for us to have a conversation about the Confederacy, slavery, the legacy of racial segregation in America?
I'm not sure, Jesse. I mean, I know, like in the country where you grew up, in South Africa, the nation was able to have a conversation at the end of apartheid with truth and reconciliation commissions. I understand that that wasn't a perfect solution, but it seems like the nation managed to peacefully move on. We don't seem to be able to have that kind of conversation in our country. It seems like we only have such a conversation after horrible tragedies, like Dylann Roof's massacre at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston, South Carolina, or now Charlottesville. But there never seems to be a satisfying resolution. In fact, what's more sobering, this morning I read this New Yorker article that cites some national security experts discussing the possibility of the United States waging some form of civil war in the future. On average, these experts said the percentage of this happening was at about 35%. And some believe the probability was more like 65%. And this conversation happened 5 months before Charlottesville.
That is a very sobering thought and certainly a tough conversation to have. As we look forward to the future, what's next for the Us and Them podcast?
Well, in response to the Charlottesville tragedy, we're reposting Mike and Rupa's Confederate Reckoning piece. And next week, we're releasing a new piece about a social class divide in Kanawha County between the Hillers and Creekers.
That sounds interesting. And Trey, thanks so much for taking the time to come in and speak with us.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Jesse. Thanks for the opportunity.
That was West Virginia Public Broadcasting News Director Jesse Wright speaking with Trey Kay, host of the Us and Them podcast about the tragedy in Charlottesville, Virginia this past weekend. To download the updated installment of Us and Them's Confederate Reckoning episode, visit our website at wvpublic.org or go to usandthempodcast.com. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Marshall University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Jesse Wright. I'm Teresa Wills.